And I will have the wheels turned toward me so that I can make sure that it's always spinning. I'm never sure about the batteries.
The red light towards me.
Yeah, that only shows that it's on, not necessarily that, you know. See, even if it's on pause, but I want to make sure that the batteries are okay and things like that. Okay, today is July 23rd. Paul Rodell here one more time. And today I'm with Robert, or Bob J. Velasco.
J for John.
Oh, yeah, not J-A-Y. Yeah, okay. Who was in Vietnam from October of 1958 to the same month of 1960. Most people would just put the years and not give us the month, so that's extra bit of detail that you have. And he has a very complete yellow form. So as I was saying before, there's not, I don't like to wear watches. You know, there's some stuff that we already know. But one thing that we did not ask on the form at all was something about your own personal background, the things that made the young Bob become the young Bob. So, starting off with when and where you were born and how you were raised and what sort of environment and the as you look back, seeing the most important influences on your life to give you your basic ideas and values. Mm-hmm. And now I can sit back and sip the coffee because you're almost done and I'm not.
Well, I was born and raised in Norwalk, Connecticut, a industrial town on Long Island Sound. Mm-hmm. My grandparents on both sides came from Europe, my father's side from Schiavi d'Abruzzo on the eastern part of Italy, and my mother's parents from Eastern Hungary. My father was in business for himself, building houses. He called himself a contractor and builder. My mother, during the war years, worked in a weaving shop, and I was left with my grandparents in my early years as she went to work. And my grandfather worked in a lock shop downtown, walked about more than five miles each way, summer, spring, fall, and winter.
Did your grandparents speak English?
Very little.
Yeah.
My grandfather had a big house with a big yard around it, not acreage, but just a very big yard.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a big house because they had a total of 12 children, nine living when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And
cheaper by the dozen.
Yeah. In the yard, there were big gardens, vegetable gardens. He planted fruit trees. This is all to help with the economic situation to feed the family.
He had a very
menial job downtown. And there was a well in the backyard, and I just used to love to go there. And I think my introduction and interest to agriculture came from that yard.
Even from an industrial town?
Yeah, from being with my grandmother and grandfather doing the garden.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I finished junior high school, we had to decide what high school course to go into. Mm-hmm. Whether it be industrial arts or college preparatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know what I wanted to do. The homeroom teacher gave us the form, and I went home, and I remember sitting around the kitchen table with my mother and father and asking them what I should do, and they finally saying, well, whatever you want, it's up to you. They both finished eighth grade, and that was it. My father always told the story that he got up to go to start ninth grade in September, and his father said, hey, where are you going to be, Chooch? He said, I'm going to school. He said, no, put your overalls on, you come work with me. So that was the end of his education.
Hmm.
And so I think I checked commercial course or one of the other courses and handed it into my homeroom teacher. She she looked through the stack, and later in the morning she said, she asked me to see her after school. I said, oh God.
What I do now.
So I did, and she said, Bob, I think this, you're making a mistake. I think you should check the college preparatory course. I think you could do that, and this way if you later decide you want to go to college, then you'll be prepared.
Right.
If you decide you don't want to go to college, well,
no big deal.
Nothing lost.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I got some advice.
Was she like an important?
She was an important person. Yes, she was one of the foremen persons.
Yeah. Yeah. What'd she teach? Or was one of those folks that did more than one of the courses?
Well, she was our homeroom teacher, and she taught English, I believe.
Uh huh. Okay. So you remember really more as the homeroom teacher than the history teacher or the science teacher,
right,
or something like that.
That's
right. Yeah.
So then I...
Oh, she knew you well enough.
Yeah, I guess. So I got through high school well enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's time to make up my mind what I wanted to do. Do I want to go to college? Well, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I knew we had the University of Connecticut in Connecticut, and it wasn't that expensive, and so I decided if I'm going to go to college, that's where I'm going to go.
What year was this now?
This was 1954.
Okay.
So I sent for the catalog, but I didn't know doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, I didn't know.
Yeah,
I
right.
I just didn't know what
typical
I wanted.
Typical freshman.
And I start looking through the catalog, and
uh-huh.
I came to plant science. And I looked down the list of courses, horticulture, vegetable, agriculture, floriculture, landscape gardening, and I said, that's me.
Yeah, this is like home. This is like the backyard.
Like a light went on. I said, and that's what I did.
Yeah.
And I got accepted, and I went.
Wow.
4 years, I did pretty well. I was intercollegiate vegetable judging champion, first place, intercollegiate floriculture judging champion, first place. That sort of thing. Then it came time to graduate from.
Now you got the real hard decision.
well, and of course there's counseling and you do interviews and that, and then you send a card into the counseling office, and they call you in when they have something they think you might be interested in. And I wasn't getting many callbacks for I don't know what reason, but it was late May, studying for finals, and in the dormitory or fraternity house, the doors were open between rooms, and this friend came through and went in the next room, and they were talking about what he went over to the counseling service
mm-hmm.
for, and he
yeah.
came back and said they had this stupid idea that I'd be interested in this organization called IVS, where they send you to some outback country and want you to work for nothing. And that's exactly what the group did. They start laughing, but I went around. I went out my door and into their door, and I said, "Let's." I don't know if I asked for the card or got the name, and I went over to the counseling service and
mm-hmm.
inquired about it.
And these were your friends? They weren't.
And so I applied.
Uh huh.
Dr. Knopf.
They must have just. Been shocked when you asked for the car.
Yeah.
I'm trying to picture this, in the fraternity house,
uh-huh.
Where they're mocking it, and somebody that they know and like turns around the corner and says, I want to do that.
Yeah. So, or I'm interested.
You can't commit.
It just appealed to me.
Well, how come? You like working for nothing?
We didn't have television, but we had movies.
Yeah.
And I would go to all the Tarzan movies and all the Jungle Jim movies and all the Arabian Nights movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And anything in the jungle or in the desert or in the outback.
Anything exotic, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah. Those are the movies I would go see. Musicals, dance films.
Mysteries, espionage.
Well, I like Sherlock Holmes
and
Charlie Chan and that.
Charlie Chan, that means
it. So I don't know if I sent an application or how it happened. This is this is now, well, over 4 years ago.
Right? Yeah, yeah, that's a while.
It's 48 years almost that I went to Vietnam. No, 38.
Yeah, 38, yeah. Whoa, whoa.
38, so. So, Dr. Nofsinger sent me an application form, and I filled it out and sent it back, and we corresponded a couple times, and he said, okay, well, we want you to go to South Vietnam. At that time, I didn't know where South Vietnam was.
Right.
I went to our local library.
And asked for the Africa Gazette?
No.
No, yes, it's here.
That was a little brighter. I went to the card catalog and found Vietnam and found out where it was, and Encyclopedia Britannica and that, and looked it up. And Asia. My interest at that time was not Asia. It was Africa, as I mentioned earlier, Africa or the desert lands.
Yeah, yeah, you would have wanted something in Iraq or something.
Something like that. That's what I thought. So I had to think hard about Asia. I just didn't know about it.
Yeah.
It was all just one big landmass. I didn't know about all these little countries. I heard about Indochina. I knew there was such a place as Indochina, but I didn't know what Vietnam was.
Okay. Nowadays, so, I say Indochina to my students, and they think China. They can't picture Indochina. Anyway, I'm sorry.
It's a different time. No, that's
fine. Yeah.
So I spent a couple weeks, maybe a couple weeks or several days, and I when I was a kid, I used to do my thinking in my father's old Pontiac in the garage. I just sit in Pontiac. And, so I finally decided that what I wrote there, that if I don't go, I'll never know what it was like, and I'd be wondering the rest of my life. What I would be like, what my life would be like if I didn't go.
And that was the clincher.
And I went, and here I am in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd probably still be in Norwalk, Connecticut.
I don't know, maybe not.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Something else, though, that you mentioned in that particular section was, see if I can get the exact word, and I know exactly what to turn to.
Get the right pair of glasses on.
Yeah, well, they don't always need them. To see if I could do some service for others and have adventure. And, of course, I got the idea of the adventure from the movie fantasies of youth.
Yeah.
But what about the idea of service? Where does that come from?
I think it's an innate or inborn character or characteristic that I think I have, because I don't know if you've walked around the streets in Washington, but there's a lot of people that live on the streets and have their hand out or a cup out, and my heart goes out to them, and I if I don't restrain myself, I give everybody something.
Yeah.
Now I try and do it once a day, the first person I see it.
Of course, they have their territory, so you might see the same person frequently.
But use your reasonableness.
Yeah.
Some people may call it a soft touch or a soft heart, and I guess that's me.
Yeah.
And I just.
Well, if you're going to have one kind of heart or another, it's better to have the soft one.
I just sort of like to do things for people.
So. Before, when we were just chatting, you said who went with you at the same time, and you mentioned, you mentioned Don Luce. You mentioned
Paul Sutton.
That's right, you did mention him.
And Dean Bowman, who went to Laos, and myself. That was the four of us.
Only four recruited at the same time.
What the recruiting time, I don't know, but...
Or shipping over.
We shipped over to
Vietnam.
Yeah,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And going to Vietnam, we were the three of us were the second group.
Okay.
And when we got there, I believe we made eight people.
Mm-hmm.
on the team.
Mm-hmm.
The other five were the first group.
Yeah.
That were up in Bonmatuit and worked with refugee villages Halana and Halan Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll see if I can remember their names.
Those first five. Sure, why not?
Let's
Brock
see.
Mueller?
Brock Mueller. Bob Yates.
Uh-huh.
Tom Lucci.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Borton was there, but I think he wasn't with the very first group. He came over a little bit later on his own.
Okay.
Or by himself.
But he was before you,
he was
at
before
least.
Me. Yeah.
Yeah.
He,
so that's up to
I
four
remember,
now?
Yeah, landing in Tunsen, yeah, we got off the plane, and there was a group on the upper level observatory deck of the Tunsen Airport building.
Uh-huh.
And Ray was waving his arms off because he recognized me and I recognized him. He was in graduate school at the University of Connecticut when I was there.
Oh, okay.
And I guess
But
I,
you were still
I,
just an undergrad.
I was an undergrad. He was
but
in
he,
graduate school.
But he knew you anyway.
Yes, because he was didn't know me. We recognized each other.
Oh, just by face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I don't know if we ever spoke at the university or not. But he was in graduate school.
They said, geez, that guy's familiar.
Well, he knew I was coming.
Ah, okay.
Because they had the names already. I guess the background from Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Probably University of Connecticut. But we became pretty good friends and chummed around together quite a bit. And well, not chummed around quite a bit because he was in one place and I was in another place.
Yeah, sure. So that's four
but
out of
But we did do our, we had a 30 days vacation a year.
Mm-hmm.
And both years we
You and Ray.
Yeah. I was a follower. He put the trip together and I said, hey, that sounds good. Let's go, you know.
Yeah. Well, how could you miss, you know?
You want me to go on with this? Or
well,
more substantial stuff?
I don't know. Just to some extent. I would like to know what your first impression was of Vietnam when you arrived.
Oh. Yeah. Well, the first impression was Saigon,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty nice. I mean, the food was great.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't too fussy eater, and I liked to try exotic things. And
if you're going to live the adventure, you got to eat it,
too. There was a nice house. They had a... it wasn't the Tansen Yit station.
Mm-hmm. That came somewhat
that
later.
That came after a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
But the team was in Bonmatuit. They had their headquarters in Bonmatuit, but they had a, and I don't know if they rented it or owned it or what, a villa type or a French, ex-French house in downtown Saigon on Haimi High Lake Widon. 22 Lake Widon Street.
Woo! That's very good.
To use when they were, had to come to Saigon.
Sure, of course, yeah.
And the team leader was Barwick.
Barwick.
Barwick. Barwick.
Mm-hmm.
What was his first name? John Barwick. And
okay.
his wife, Laura Barwick, who was an heiress, a Hershey heiress. She was from the Hershey family.
Mm-hmm.
And John did quite a bit of work in with refugees after the Second World War.
Oh.
And then got involved with IDS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
is this the adventure as you begin to experience
oh
this?
Oh no, not yet. Well. So anyway, what I'm saying is my Saigon was pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice town. Nice
yeah.
tree-lined. Boulevards and all, and then we went to Bonmatuit after a few days, and where we got together with the chief to work on our language, and that was about a month, and those conditions were not as high class or not as elegant. It was
of course
a country town,
right?
And they had at that time they had a farm they were developing, or land they were making a farm.
Mm-hmm.
Making into a farm, and they were clearing the jungle and planting. The big crop was kinaf.
Okay.
And but that was fine too. I enjoyed that.
Sure.
And then it came time to split up to our new locations. And I forget how many, but there was a Land Rover load of us that went from Bonmituit across the, I forget the name of the dirt road, but down to the coast.
Uh-huh.
And we dropped Paul Sutton off at Phan Rang. I think it was, I don't know if that was a new station. He was the first one there, or someone else was there. And then we went further down the coast, and then back up into the beginning of the Highlands, and they dropped me off at Blau.
Blau.
Which later became Bao Lak.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. Yeah. Because I was looking down at your form, I said, oh.
Blau was a Montagnard name.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And they Blau.
Vietnamese.
And they Vietnamese it into Bao Lak.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And they left me off there. The arrangements, they had a little duplex which consisted of two rooms on the grounds of the old French plantation experiment station. It was an experiment station for plantation crops.
Oh, okay. And that was going to be your job, basically, to
right.
try to...
No, not really. Do you want all that detail?
Well, you had mentioned that you were working with irrigation systems for plantation crops and such,
yeah.
So I thought
yes,
that...
Yes, so that's my background. I went there for vegetables.
Correct.
So across the road from this older plantation crop experiment station was a new, which was originated by the French.
Right.
Because they were interested in coffee, tea, and
rubber. Exportables at
right,
a high value.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Across the road, the Vietnamese were putting in a vegetable experiment station.
Ah, okay.
For the introduction of new improved varieties of vegetables that might increase their
food
source and productivity.
Yeah.
So that was my primary interest. However, I worked with a Mr. Lewandowski.
You mentioned
who was a refugee white Russian
uh-huh.
who worked for, I don't know for whom, but the government during the war developing better strains of rubber because
mm-hmm.
rubber was very important for tires during the war.
Okay,
and then,
so for our government?
Yes, U.S.
Okay.
government.
Mm-hmm.
And then he retired from that, or the war ended or something or other,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
he got into USAM or AID, and he was sent to Vietnam to work on plantation crops. And he was the only horticulturist with USAM, and I was a horticulturist, so we got together.
Absolutely.
And his interest was plantation crops, so I worked. He came back and forth from Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and I was on location in Bao Lak.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with the projects, and I sort of oversaw them and ran them on a day-to-day basis there.
Yeah, yeah. So that sounds like an excellent team.
Mm.
It really does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really, like, hand in glove, not an AID, just
mm-hmm.
guy just coming in and say, oh, your name's what, Sam? No, Bob, you know, do this, you
That's
know,
right.
but a real cooperative
and
venture.
We still send Christmas cards back and forth. He lives in Miami, Florida now, and he married his housekeeper,
uh-huh.
in Vietnamese.
Wow.
Eventually.
Oh, she's... But how old was he when you knew him?
He seemed like an old man.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was in his 60s. But it's hard.
Well, he'd be 90
when
now.
You're 21. It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
Ages of older. So well, I don't know. He was quite a man. He as I say. He escaped. He was a white Russian and escaped from Russia, and.
17, 18, whatever, 19, yeah.
16, and made his way to France
uh-huh.
and went through agriculture school there.
Was he part of royalty, or perhaps he was Jewish, or?
No, he's not Jewish, Lewandowski. I always thought he was from Kiev.
Uh-huh.
But in later correspondence, I find out he was originally from Lithuania, and then they moved to Kiev.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa.
Yeah, so maybe some sort of Lithuanian nationalist or something like that.
I'm not sure.
Well, anyway, this
anyway,
is, yeah.
You talked about the... you asked me how I felt when I first got to Vietnam, and I told you about Saigon and Bamituat, and now they left me, sort of, as it was.
Kind of just in scruff of the neck and throw you off the jeep, huh?
Right. in Bao Lak.
Yeah.
And I had this little two-room bungalow they had for me, and I remember sitting on the front step saying, what am I doing here? You know, what kind of a big mistake did I make? What'll I do tomorrow? You know.
Why, did you think you were in over your head?
Well, probably, yeah. I mean, this was really primitive. There was no running water. A man came every morning with a tank, with a bullock cart with a tank of water on it, and put water in the cistern behind the house.
Uh-huh.
I bathed in the stream down the road.
Mm-hmm.
When the women weren't washing their clothes in it.
Yeah.
I took my meals in a there was a neighboring refugee, and when I say refugee, these are refugees from the French War, that came down.
They're
from
the Northerners.
North. Yes.
Catholic. Yeah.
And they came, a lot of them in village groups.
Yeah.
And there were a lot around Blau. Bao Lak.
Mm-hmm.
And we always refer to them as refugees.
Even though they were already pretty much settled.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was it. And I went, you know, what do I do the next day? Well, pretty soon Mr. Lewandowski came up and went over. The agriculture school was also located there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I eventually moved after a couple months from this little hovel that I described. And at night, rats would run across the bed.
While you're in it.
Yeah.
I had a rat that would go across the ceiling, the rafter above me, and we would always just watch it go back and forth.
But after about 2 months, I moved onto the campus of the agricultural school, which still wasn't, it was in graduate student housing, which there was a row of three, again, duplexes. This time I went from two rooms to three rooms, little rooms, all cement.
Yeah.
This had running water and a cookhouse in the back. And I was, I wasn't absolutely by myself. I was with an interpreter.
Yeah, that's okay.
Wengo Bao. And he's the one that lives in Connecticut now.
And his name was what?
Wengo Bao.
Gwen?
I'll write it for you later.
Bao. Okay.
When Mock, N-G-O-C.
Okay.
And because I didn't have sufficient language to be on my own at that time, and we always had an interpreter with us, even if our language did become better. So
how good did your language become?
Well, I tell you, I was surprised one time when I was in the market or somewhere, and I spoke some Vietnamese, and this woman turned around and said, with a big surprise look on her face, says, oh, I thought that was a Vietnamese speaker. But I had the accent, the pronunciation.
You had the intonation, yeah.
My vocabulary, I couldn't get in deep conversation. I could do day-to-day, you know, how much is this? And I knew the names of the fruits and the trees and the crops and how much and how many, but to talk about politics
or philosophy or religion. Well, that's pretty good, you know. I mean,
So anyway, eventually we had Lewandowski introduce us to the university people and the experiment station people, and day by day I got to love it, and it became the best 2 years of my life today.
Oh yeah.
To date.
Yeah. No, I can understand that. How did you figure out your day by day? I mean, Lewandowski was there to give you some general guidance, but who did you really work with? because he was, you know, back in Saigon.
Yeah, yeah,
he would visit
yeah.
you, and you'd go over the, as I understand it,
yeah.
go over the master plan. But then
I had projects of my own that mm-hmm. involved the vegetables. And
yeah.
I don't know if I'm there. I think I may have put that I was the first, as far as I know, the first one in Vietnam to bulb onions.
Yes, you said something like that.
And that's not because I'm so bright. It's because finally day neutral onion seed, onion variety became available.
Uh-huh.
And they would
okay.
bulb there. Prior to that, you need long days to bulb onions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's more to it than that. You need short and then long. Short first and then long. We have photoperiodic, so
yeah.
you need a certain...
Well, many things are, but
yeah.
you mean very sensitive.
Being that close to the equator, the days never got long enough to bulb onions until these new varieties
oh.
from the University of Texas became available.
Oh, okay.
So I got a hold of some seeds, and lo and behold, they bulbed.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was a hero.
So, yeah, you could go, and instead of being Johnny Appleseed, you could be
no, but I was
Bob Bulb.
That I was more famous for, they used to call me Bobby Cacao, and that's
mm-hmm.
that's where the grape adventure was.
Yeah.
With the cocoa, the cacao seed. And
what made that so good?
It got me into the jungles with the Montagnard, with the Ma people,
mm-hmm.
which were very...
It just starts. But, okay, so the cacao got you into the jungle. This
yeah.
is what you really wanted.
Yeah. So there was the vegetable projects where I would bring seed over and try out cultural methods that I knew back home and
mm-hmm.
primarily varieties, trying to find a better variety than the scrawny little tomatoes they had or
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
gnarly little carrots and that sort of thing. Not saying they didn't have, they had some very, you know, what goes to the market is some really beautiful stuff. They had bulbing onions, but they were imported from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So now, this is the first time they could bulb onions. And then the second project was Lewandowski's, which was the constant mist irrigation system where we tried to asexually root various plantation crops.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of out of my field.
That seems like it might have been really hard to take. Hard to take in the sense of become adapted.
No.
No?
Well, you mean the technique or?
The cultural practice.
Well, I had propagation in school, so I...
Yeah, but I mean that the farmers would pick up on and sustain
okay,
as a...
Okay, no, it wasn't for extension. It wasn't for farmers.
That's what I understood.
No, we were trying to develop a propagation system where we could root avocado and tea and coffee
yeah.
and then distribute those little trees, the rooted cuttings, to farmers.
Ah,
It wasn't to have the farmers
do it themselves.
Do the system, right?
Oh, okay, all right.
Now,
yeah.
some big plantation, tea plantation or coffee plantation could do that.
Yeah, then they'd have a whole team that they would hire.
Yeah, they had the people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it...
But they'd be responsible for it. Was the farmer...
Do you want
the details of this system? not the details, because I think that would be pretty, horticulturally...
I don't mean that take... But let me just say a little bit about it. It was easy to do there, because to get the medium, like sand or
mm-hmm.
something, all you had to do was build a fire on the ground, or a pit,
uh-huh.
and make it hot.
Mm-hmm.
And the soil, and I don't remember what it's called now, but the soil, once you bake it, is like, it becomes like brick.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all these little brick granules that don't become mud when they're wet again. They stay hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just, you build your fire, you take the ashes away, you dig up and scoop up this soil that are all is granulated brick,
yeah.
and you put it in your bed. Now all you need is a source of water. You get spray nozzles imported from Japan or Hong Kong or somewhere. And you need a source of water. We dammed up a little stream.
Mm-hmm.
And by gravity, the water came down. And lo and behold, we
hooked up the piping, and lo and behold, you had
the constant mist
system.
Yeah.
And you put your cuttings in and hope they rooted.
That's not that complicated,
sun,
and it's really
full tropical sun.
Uh-huh.
But you had a constant mist, so your cuttings didn't wilt and didn't burn up because they're always enveloped in water, in a mist.
Doesn't the water, though, magnify some of the rays of the sun?
That's a fiction.
Is it? Been a fiction.
The
old wives' tale,
yeah,
I've been laboring at it.
The fiction is that when a droplet comes onto a leaf and sits there, it serves as a prism and may concentrate the rays. But I don't think that's even true. But anyway, the mist was constant moving, constant cooling.
Yeah, okay.
It didn't sit.
So even if that was
right.
Even if that myth was in fact
true,
it didn't hold in this particular case. Okay.
Then the third job was also Levandowski's, and there were three that I did, the vegetables and the constant mist, the plantation crops, and the cacao. It was his idea.
That sounds like the most interesting of all.
It is, yeah. It was his idea to cacao didn't grow in the country.
Mm-hmm.
There was a tree or two at the Botanic Gardens in downtown Saigon, and maybe an isolated place here and there in the country. But as a crop, it didn't exist. So his idea was to bring cocoa seed into the country and sprout them and distribute the seedlings to Vietnamese farmers as a cash crop.
Yeah.
To plantation owners to see if they would take it up. And at that time, they were both French, leftover French, who owned land and ran plantations, and Vietnamese plantation owners. And the third was to give the seedlings to the Montagnard, to the Ma, as they're semi-nomadic, the Ma. They slash and burn, plant their dryland rice, and after two or three years, they have to move because that piece of land is depleted. But they don't move for that reason. They move because something auspicious happens. Somebody has an accident, gets bitten by a snake, dies. Something bad has happened, so it's time to move. And so they slash and burn. Now the government was afraid that this moving, this nomadic process, and I believe it did, brought them under the influence or in contact with the Viet Cong, and would turn their minds and hearts against the government. So they would rather they stayed in one place, where they would have contact by government people from time to time.
So that was the motivation more than, say, conservation of the forests and prevention of erosion and the like.
What was
the motivation to root the Montagnard in one place?
Yes.
Didn't concern so much preservation of forests or prevention of erosion.
Not as far as I was aware.
Yeah. Okay.
That's today.
That's what the Philippine government will always say. That they're cutting down the forests and we're losing forest and we've got soil erosion because the earth is scarred and things like that. So,
Well, that's another story. I could say more about that.
I never believed it, and I thought they were just trying to protect the logging interests.
They've been doing it for thousands of years. And the little piece they do and move on, and it sprouts right up.
Yeah.
But anyway,
it depends on how many people are doing it at the same time.
Right.
Yeah.
And there aren't
very
many.
No.
Not like when they're bringing in bulldozers and clearing huge acreages and bringing people from the cities to make them farmers.
Yeah, or from north to south because of the 54 agreements. That's different.
So, if you're going to keep these people in one place, in one village, then they can't grow this rice anymore because it won't continue growing on this depleted ground.
Yeah, after a while. After about 3 to 5 years.
Right.
Yeah.
So they need a cash crop.
Mm-hmm.
And it was thought that this cocoa might be the cash crop.
It's not necessarily a bad thought.
And it's good for the jungle because you don't need to clear the land to grow the cacao. You just clear the undergrowth because it needs shade. It's a shade crop.
Mm-hmm.
So you leave the upper story trees and you plant underneath.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that's what we were doing.
So it's an intercrop kind of thing,
yeah.
rather than a true plantation.
Right.
Yeah.
So we would, first we made exploratory
uh-huh.
trips, and
uh-huh.
we drive down to the Dadung River.
Who's we? You
and Lewandowski.
Lewandowski.
And
okay.
the chief of Canton, who was a Mat. Under the Vietnamese government, the
chief of what?
Canton. Canton, C-A-N-T-O-N, Canton.
Yeah. Oh, okay,
it's
all right.
It's that you have your province, and then you have cantons within the
okay,
province, like
right.
counties.
All right, because I hadn't heard that term applied to Vietnam yet. Nobody has talked about that level of administration.
I think, you know, it may not be, I'm not sure it was, we were in Lâm Đâm province,
uh-huh.
but under the Vietnamese administration
uh-huh.
of their towns and hamlets, I'm not sure they had cantons. But the unit of space for the tribes were cantons.
Oh, okay.
It may also apply to the Vietnamese government, but I can't, governing body.
It may be right. more what you're suggesting, that
mm-hmm.
it's the more the tribal thing.
So the chief of Canton would always come,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and he was a tribal.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd meet us somewhere, either at the river or up in Bao Lac.
Uh-huh.
And we'd go to the river, and they'd have the dugout canoes ready, and these are real dugout canoes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, half a log,
a log
burned,
and split
and
burned. Yeah.
And I have pictures of how they're made. And we would go upriver, not that one. You see it up? Upriver.
Mm-hmm.
Upriver, and we get off at. I could almost name the villages still, but I'd have to think a little bit. Let's just say the first village,
yeah.
which was like 20 to 30 feet above the river, and the river being down a cliff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We just wore down. And then we do our little thing there, and when I say do our little thing, one, we're looking for suitable areas near the village that would be that might grow cacao. We didn't even know if it grow yet.
Mm-hmm.
Um,
so you'd be looking
type.
For the proper forest cover,
soil
type. Yeah,
that
uh-huh.
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go overland now, and this mm-hmm. is the adventure. It'd be like single file down the jungle trail, like
slash
jungle.
Slash with the machete.
Not too much slash because
I just kind of like getting into
broke,
the spirit of it.
But single file with backpacks
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
these people with both men and women with just their loincloth or
mm-hmm.
sarong and their feathers in their hair and their koop koop, which, you know, the koop koop?
No.
Is the axe.
Okay.
A piece of bamboo. And
mm-hmm.
You might want to turn that. It's a piece of bamboo that's put in fire and makes this turn, and this part is the root crop, or the root end,
uh-huh.
and they put a blade in here.
Hmm, okay.
And
so they make like a little axe,
it's an axe yeah.
kind of thing out of
and
it.
And then there's others that are battle axes that have a war axes.
Ooh.
Or ceremonial that are shaped like
good
this.
That it's just ceremonial.
Yeah, and they have a blade.
That looks like an S curve.
That's right. A blade like this. Very
uh-huh.
artistic.
Artistic and coming up higher uh-huh. with a little hook in it.
Yeah.
It almost looks like the Olympic torch.
Yeah. And spears and bows and arrows and,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and listening for a herd of elephant or something that might be grazing nearby so we could avoid
mm-hmm. any encounters.
Yeah, and then we get to the next village, and if it's time enough, we go to the third village and we stay overnight there, and then the
mm-hmm.
next day the fourth village, and usually 3 or 4 days, but by the fifth day we'd be on our way back.
Yeah, you know, just to pause it a second, because you're describing the Ma group. And before, when we were just chatting, I told you my preconception of all Montagnard was at a higher cultural level.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying, no, that these folks were really, you know, as you describe now, again,
with
the loincloth clothing,
mm-hmm.
women with sarong and no top, mm-hmm. and slash and burn agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. Would they be at the bottom of the Montagnard hierarchy in terms of how other mountain groups perceive them? I mean, certainly the Vietnamese, as I understand it, pretty much look down at all mountain people.
Yeah, they call them Moi.
Yeah, an insult. Whether it's a tribal hill group that has a very elaborate culture, or these folks mm-hmm. who had a very, let's say, a simple culture.
This group would are the simplest I know of.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there might be some, but
yeah.
you know, I know of these.
Uh-huh.
I know of the Rade up around uh-huh. Bamatuak, which are, and the Mao, the
uh-huh.
black and the white ties. And I think there's black and white Mao too. And the Manung, the Manungar. And these I think would be lower down on the on the cultural
yeah.
Developmental.
Yeah, that's probably good
yeah.
enough.
Yeah.
yeah, so but would the groups that would be higher up look down upon them as the Vietnamese look down on everyone?
I don't know that.
You don't know, okay.
I haven't had that much contact with those other groups.
Okay. Oh, that's important.
I've been,
yeah.
Yeah. I've been visiting Rade's in their village, but you know, you don't talk
but
about
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
Thing.
Your visits
you
would
visit
pick
Rade's
up
in around Ban Matuit, and there'd be no Mois, no male, no Ma walking on the street where someone might say, look at that jerk or something.
Yeah, yeah.
There's
yeah.
no contact.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't know how they I'm sure
how
they
fared
knew,
in
but, right.
Yeah, in the social hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that just occurred to me,
mm-hmm.
and I thought I'd interrupt your story going from village to village to just ask you about the folks, but I'm sorry.
I brought a couple albums if you want to see what they look like.
Okay.
After we finish taping.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. We could do that. But anyway, going from, I did interrupt your story. You've gone from the first village and then not exactly hacking your way through the jungle,
yeah,
but going up to a visit on the second to do more
day,
exploratory.
Yeah, and they were all-day treks, you know, you just kept going all day. You didn't.
By the third village, you're exhausted and it's getting towards evening.
Yeah, and the third village is a lot. You start at one, right. You could do three in a day, right.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was generally the trip. And they were, the first ones were exploring places to find.
Yeah.
I'm getting tongue-tied here. Maybe I need a sip of coffee.
Yeah.
And then.
Well, you're certainly allowed. I mean, it's your office.
Mm-hmm. And then, Dr. Lewandowski arranged for the cacao seed to be imported. And
mm-hmm.
cacao is very tricky. It has to be planted wet. I mean, you have to open the fruit
uh-huh.
and plant the seed. It's not like normal seed where you dry it out and you know you dry it and it can stay on the shelf
yeah.
for years, but this has to be planted fresh.
Uh-huh.
So the pods came in
uh-huh.
and fruit and you had to open them up and the soil mixture and containers with little plastic bags.
Uh-huh.
Planted the seed, but in Vietnam they had for some reason I think they had to put shade over everything, so they put under shade. And they grew up about so, I'm doing about a foot.
Yeah.
And then we put those in the truck and went down to the river,
uh-huh.
loaded them on the dugout canoes, and went from village to village, dropping off the supplies. In the meantime.
And you had the Canton leader as kind of like
yeah.
the spokesman and the authority figure so that people would line up.
Right.
Okay.
And then in the meantime, the village people
uh-huh.
would have cleared their rows under the trees
uh-huh. so that they were ready.
They were ready for it to be planted.
Uh-huh.
And we asked them to mix ashes in a little hole.
From their cooking fires?
From cooking fires.
Okay.
That's for fertilizer.
Yeah,
phosphorus.
Potter.
And they were planted.
Mm-hmm.
And then another trip, we'd come and see how they were doing. Another trip, we'd see that their bugs were just eating them up terribly. And another trip, we'd bring
DDT or something, God forbid anybody hear me say that, and showed them how to apply it within a rag and dab it on.
Oh, oh my.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
The sins of the past. And so that was, you know, several trips, and then 2 years were up, and I went home.
Did they do well?
They did well, yes. I have pictures in there. Mm-hmm. They did well. The war came, and I don't know what happened to
yeah,
them.
Yeah. May I pause?
Sure.
Because, but anyway, I turned this back on again.
Okay.
So that was one phase. That's the third, my third job. But it wasn't exclusively with the Montagnard. We also,
yeah, just
we also put these cocoa plants with Vietnamese farmers.
Oh, as well. Okay.
And on some of these larger tea plantations.
Mm-hmm. Where did it seem to work out best, at least as far as your time there?
Where did
it seem to take the best?
They seem to grow equally well in the various locations in that province.
Okay, so the cultural practices of
uh-huh.
any of the three types
uh-huh.
of farmers
uh-huh.
were all conducive to the
yeah.
plant.
Yeah. Now, again, my imagination, without going back, my imagination tells me that what was planted amongst the Ma in the jungle are lost. And I hear from people who come back like Chi
mm-hmm.
that there is a small local chocolate industry now. You can get candies
mm-hmm.
and they make chocolate for drinks,
mm.
but not export, which was to be the big thing. Back then, in those particular years, and of course the chocolate market fluctuates from
mm-hmm.
a couple of years to a couple of years. The market was very good internationally, which means that the cocoa production
mm-hmm.
was low in South America, Africa, Malaya.
Mm-hmm.
I think our seeds came from Malaya. So if we could get a crop grown in Vietnam, the market would be good for what it is now, what it was after that. And of course, during the 60s, during war years.
Right.
If it wasn't for the war, there might have been, or if the war, how can you redo history? But
yeah.
If it didn't get as bad as it did, there might well be a chocolate industry for
mm.
export in Vietnam.
Hmm. Yeah, because it seemed to take off that well,
mm-hmm.
and then especially if IVS had assigned mm-hmm. someone else to follow up on your work as well, then it could have, or did they?
Well, Bob Kunschchild went there after me, and
really,
yeah.
Let me look him up and see where he might be.
Yeah, and but you're absolutely right. The next person coming in has their own. I would think the feeling is, well, I don't want to do what he did. I want to do my own, make my own mark. I want to do my own thing.
Oh, it's K. I was looking under C.
You want to turn that off while you're looking?
No, that's all right. Oh, here he is. Robert A. Kneern. Schild. 199 Jackson Street, Augusta, Mo. And there's nothing written above his name. So that could mean that he hasn't turned anything in. Bad fellow. We'll have to get on his case.
Mm-hmm. So
anyway,
he could continue the story from
yeah. If he has anything, okay. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you did fill in your form, you mentioned how the initial relations that you had with your coworkers were somewhat cool, in a sense that you
cool.
had to sort of win them over somehow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think part of one of the reasons that you gave, now I'm going off into memory here, was that here you are, you're this young kid, fresh out of school, 21 years old. You're in a society that venerates age and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
You have this
okay.
young punk coming in and tell us what
exactly.
to do. So that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I understand that problem from a generic cultural basis. But there seemed to be something about turf too, that you were going to do something that they were going to do, or conflict with what they wanted to do, or something. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
If you could clarify this for me, you know, I'd help. It would help.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, here I was left there.
Yeah, dumped off at the roadside. I love that. I love
almost
that.
Because they had to be to Saigon by evening, or later. You know, they were going. They weren't staying over. They were going from Lao to.
Is that because of security?
No.
No, they had appointments.
They just, yeah. As a, you know, they did spend the night there. Whoever was left they spent one night there. And then
with you?
Yeah.
Okay.
We were in that one little bungalow.
Okay.
Yeah.
But still, you're dumped.
Yeah.
You are dumped. Yeah.
So now I'm with Bao. Between the trips of Lewandowski, I'm have to do my what I was there to do.
Mm-hmm.
Work with vegetables, which was what I knew, what I knew better, and then these other projects as we went along.
Mm-hmm.
So we go over to the Daibin experiment station.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd look around and find things to do, you know. And they had there was the manager, and he had his kais, which are the bosses under him, under managers, one, two. And I'm looking around, what do I do? And it was a little cool, you know, this is their, and I don't know how I was explained.
That's right, you have no way to know that.
So I'm just sort of hanging around, and I asked for some land to plant some things, and they gave it to me.
Mm-hmm.
That location wasn't so bad, and these were primarily northern refugees from the north that were in the villages surrounding Baolak. I use the word interchangeably. But over at the university, as I say, was an agricultural school, and I use the term university loosely. And if they had livestock, and they had some acreage that they planted vegetable. There was a Baksi Tuk, who was the vegetable professor.
Okay.
And he was cool to me in the beginning, but. Mm-hmm. After a while, we got along fine, joked, and I'd go nosing around his plots, and why don't you do this a little different? And, you could see where that was going, but even
why don't you do this different?
I dropped in at the dean, the head man of the school, president of the agricultural school, and whatnot. And in the beginning, and Bao wouldn't tell me this for a long time, but he says, you know, that man doesn't like you. He refers to you as Ngu, which is fool.
Really?
Yeah. And what's his name? Tun.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Tun. And, but after a while, I think he stopped referring to me as Ngu, and we got along fine.
Mm-hmm.
After a short time, now we're talking about three places, the vegetable farm, the university, and then now we're back at the plantation experiment station, who had another director.
Mm-hmm. Director. They're going to be...
Now, the vegetable station was under this director. It was the new part of the...
Over the plantation thing?
Of the plantation experiment
station. So that was a twofer.
Yeah. And this new director was an old man. His teeth would just almost pop out of his mouth as he talked. And his name was...
It's a good image.
His name was Baksi Ka. Ka. And he was an old man, and I was 21 or 22 again. And I respect him, and he condescended to talk to me or respond to me. And then, about the third, or I don't know how many visits to his office, but I went into his office, and Lewandowski wasn't with me, it was just Bao and I,
And he just, his face just shone bright as the sun. And he made this fabulous discovery that he and I were related.
Because his name, and I'll make up the first two names because I don't remember it. Let's say Gwen Van Ka, and I was Falaka. Falaska in Vietnamese comes out Falaka.
Oh no.
And we were of the same, we had the same
name. Lineage.
So he just loved me from then on.
What a little twist of fate.
Yeah.
That's great. Oh, and he was beaming. Mm. Beautiful. Oh.
Okay.
I was, okay, that's, see, I had reread your thing last night, and that's why I was curious about this statement that you had about the initial reactions of the various people. And
yeah,
it seems like what you're doing is fitting in culturally.
Now, yeah.
And being fitted in culturally.
Right. And these were, these three situations were like going into an established factory and trying to make room for yourself.
Yeah.
Now,
or an office like this.
Yeah. When I would stop with a farmer, with a villager, and let's talk about what you're growing, and do you have space to put out some? Oh, and we worked also with lacquer, and would you have a place to try some of this cacao? And I felt I wasn't comfortable doing that, not because of the person, but asking a farmer who had limited land to try this thing he didn't know about. And if it didn't work, even with the vegetable stuff,
that's
onions
right.
or something,
it's
taking like food off of the table of his family.
Absolutely.
So I was very hesitant to do that, but we did that to some extent.
And farmers
but
are
reception with the local people
mm-hmm.
was just wonderful. I mean, maybe it was just in front of my face, but they...
It was probably genuine.
It was just great. And I really had genuine affection for them as well.
Yeah, my own experience is that farmers in that situation are risk takers to a degree. Mm-hmm. That they know that they should be able to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone's going to offer them hope, they're more than willing to give it a shot. So I've always had a lot of respect because there's people in the West who are wealthier, who are more conservative with their resources. I mean, these people are cutting it very close
That's
to
right.
the bone, and yet they'll say, yeah, I can give you that little patch, and I'll give this a try. Because they're desperate to try something.